The global energy supply crisis has been good for Alberta's economy. The development of the Athabasca tar sands in northern Alberta has created more jobs, more profits, and more government revenue. Canada has become, and will likely remain, the largest foreign supplier of energy resources to the world's biggest consumer, the United States. But the expanding Alberta oil industry may also be creating extensive environmental and social damage, as well as a national energy security crisis. These problems are explored in Fueling Fortress America, a report on the Athabasca tar sands and U.S. demands for Canada's energy. The report was sponsored by the Parkland Institute, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and the Polaris Institute. Hugh McCollum is the author of Fueling Fortress America. He joins me now by phone from Toronto. Hello, Hugh.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How important are the Alberta tar sand deposits to the global oil market?
They're the second largest reserves in the world, and more likely the largest reserves in the world. They have proven reserves of well over 200 billion barrels and estimated reserves of somewhere up to 2.5 trillion barrels of oil. It's not very good oil, not very easily extracted, but it's there, and the only other reserve that's close to it is those in Saudi Arabia, where oil figures are suspect and subject to being state secrets. So they're extremely important, especially when they're close to the United States, which has consumes 25 million barrels of oil a day.
How does oil extraction from the tar sands differ from that of conventional oil?
Well, basically, conventional oil is pumped out of the ground from large underground pools, or now declining underground pools, and the tar sands are either mined by the use of huge shovels and trucks and so on, or they are pumped out of the ground through a complicated process of injecting steam deep into the earth's surface, and the stuff is the sand, tar sand is actually melted and then pumped back up in a sort of tar-like substance. It's not really oil. It's bitumen, which is somewhere across between coal and oil in the geological process. And so it requires great amounts of energy and great amounts of heat and great amounts of water to get it to a point where it can become liquid enough to be refined into more conventional oil, which is why it's often called synthetic oil.
Why are we using up a lot of natural resources to get this synthetic resource?
Canada is running, like the United States, has reached its peak of conventional oil. In fact, the whole world has reached its peak of conventional oil, and which means that we have used up over 50% of the world's endowment of oil since the beginning of time, and we are now on the way down. So we've reached the peak, we're on the way down, and the oil that is accessible now is in the most difficult parts of the world to get. It's deep under the water, deep under the land. It's in forms like the tar sands, and consequently much more expensive and much more hazardous to get out. We in Canada especially in Alberta, are at the end of a long series of pipelines that have taken conventional oil from Alberta and Saskatchewan to the United States for years, and now the Americans have made oil their number one security policy. We are looked upon very favorably, of course, because we are stable. unlike the Middle East or Africa, where other large deposits of oil are, we don't aren't enemies of the United States the way Hugo Chavez is in Venezuela, and so they would love to get as much of our tar sands oil as they can get their hands on. And right now, they're getting 1 million barrels a day, but by the end of the decade, they hope, they meaning the oil companies, hope to have it up to about 6 million barrels a day. So we are the largest foreign supplier of oil to the United States now in the world.
And under NAFTA, Canada can't reduce the proportion of oil that is exported, even if we have something like a domestic energy crisis. One of your recommendations in the report is that the Canadian government obtain an exemption to what to this clause, what's called the proportional sharing clause. Can you explain how this could be done?
Well, I can try. It's very complicated, as a lot of things in NAFTA are. But basically, when Brian Mulroney signed NAFTA, we agreed to a clause that says that we cannot reduce our exports to the United States at any level lower than the immediate previous 3 years. So that means we have to stay at that level for a three-year period, and then we can apply to reduce exports, which is almost impossible and has never been done. Mexico, the other partner in NAFTA, did not sign that particular clause and is exempt from the proportionality ratio. What we are proposing is that Canada engage in a national debate, a national discussion involving all shareholders and stakeholders that would reignite or re-emphasize a new energy strategy for Canada based on meeting our own needs and our own future reserves, and withdraw from that NAFTA clause that prevents us from cutting our exports. Now that would be very difficult, but if a government had the political will, it could be done. There are options in NAFTA that have never been tested that would allow us to declare an emergency, and then we would have to go before NAFTA hearings and ask if we could have our oil reduced. Or thirdly, we could, having given sufficient notice, we could withdraw from NAFTA altogether, which of course many people think would be the best solution, but none of the three solutions available to us today is either easy or something that would that many politicians would want to take on. You can tell that from the difficulty we've had with the softwood lumber discussions.
In the report, you talk about Canada's National Energy Board as being a toothless regulator of the energy industry. Does the NEB need a stronger mandate?
Well, it doesn't actually need a stronger mandate. It needs to implement the mandate that it has. The legislation which set up the National Energy Board as Canada's national energy regulator in 1959 are still in place. But when the National Energy Program was discarded by the Mulroney government in 1985, and the National Energy Board was moved to Calgary from Ottawa, it was given instructions to be much more favorable to the major multinational oil companies and pipeline companies, and so now it holds hearings and it makes decisions, but the decisions are very soft on exploration, development, and construction of pipelines, because there is no policy, federal policy, on the export, transportation, or use, pricing, any of those things of oil. In fact, Canada doesn't even have a Ministry of Energy. It doesn't have an energy minister. All of the regulation of the oil industry is done by the provinces. And but since we are a federal country where big manufacturing provinces like Ontario and Quebec need oil, we are actually importing almost exactly as much oil as we export from the tar sands to the United States, 900,000 barrels a day that we import to Montreal via the from Venezuela, actually. So we are selling our oil at world prices and having to buy back oil needed for Ontario and Quebec primarily, even though there is a pipeline from Western Canada straight through to Montreal.
What about the provincial governments? How is Alberta managing its energy development?
Well, from the point of view of the multinational oil companies, it's managing it very well. Alberta has appallingly low environmental standards, and the oil sands are one of the are the single largest polluter of or emitter of greenhouse gases in the country. It has very low royalty rates, which means that the province that owns the resource gets a very small amount of revenue from the oil companies, compared, say, with Norway, which is a tiny country, has a an oil fund of over $200 billion. Ours is, Alberta's is around 12, and is actually declining while the oil sands are booming. So, and the regulation of labor, the regulation of the infrastructure is all very pro corporation, and so Alberta, from a company perspective, is doing well by the oil, but from the point of view of the environment, from the point of view of health, from the point of view of social services, and from the point of view of the huge use of water in refining the tar sands, the province is doing very badly.
The pipeline that supplies the gas to the tar sands goes through Canada's north, and in the report you document some of the environmental damage there. The government of the Northwest Territories doesn't have the same power as Alberta, though, to regulate or set any policy for the industry?
All resource development in the Northwest Territories is controlled by the federal government, which doesn't really have an energy policy. The pipeline is not yet built. The natural gas that's being used in the Athabasca tar sands is from very rapidly declining reserves in Alberta, and so the tar sands developers, Imperial Oil and the major oil companies in Canada, which are all owned by the Americans, want to revive the Mackenzie Valley project, a pipeline project from the Beaufort Sea, from the Mackenzie Delta, to run straight down the Mackenzie Valley and then across to the tar sands. That will take about 7 years to build. It'll cost about $7 billion. It will have profound effects on both the social and environmental aspects of the Northwest Territories. And it will deplete the last big major reserves of natural gas, which is a clean fuel. It will deplete those reserves very rapidly, to manufacture a dirty, highly polluting synthetic oil, which will be exported to the United States.
The town of Fort McMurray, which is sort of the hub of Alberta's north, just recently approved work camps in the middle of town to provide temporary housing for up to 300 workers per camp to meet the demand for housing in the area. There has been some concern from local residents and businesses about crime and violence as a result, and you discuss some of the social problems of the region in your report. What did you see in Fort McMurray?
Fort McMurray is a typical, almost extreme caricature of an old-fashioned northern boomtown. Its salaries are huge for labor and even higher for skilled labor in the development of the tar sands. The town has huge shortages of affordable housing, and by affordable housing I mean a single room costing $1,500 a month. It has a lot of people coming from different parts of the country, from Newfoundland to BC, who are you know, mobile and have big money, and there's lots of bars, and so the turnover of the population is enormous. People don't, families don't stay. There's nothing to do except drink in the town. So people spend every weekend driving 500 kilometers to Edmonton and back on roads that are extremely bad. There have been some horrendous accidents and many people killed. There is not enough housing that's in any way affordable. So people are being put in these transient camps. The camps out on the construction sites are just simply bunkhouses, and are very poor quality. The services in Fort McMurray, which is the third largest concentration of population in Alberta, things like medicine, medical facilities, police, businesses, small businesses, repair of roads, sewage disposal, all that kind of thing, there's no money for it. And Fort McMurray Rural Municipality hasn't got the income to hire nurses and doctors and policemen at the rates of pay that they can get that would be comparable to laborers. So the turnover of all of the essential services of Fort McMurray is almost daily. It's well known, I'm told by young people, as the crystal meth capital of Canada. Everybody in all parts of Canada knows Franklin Street, which is where you can buy crystal meth on the corners. Somebody serving coffee in Tim Hortons gets a minimum of $15 an hour, and they can't get staff. And so it's a really badly organized, badly run, badly controlled, regulated boomtown. And it's just set in the bush, and the province owns all the land around it. So Fort McMurray as a municipality has no control of its own infrastructure. Nearby, up the highway that goes to the actual site of the tar sands, are a number of First Nations reserves. They're Dene and Chipewyan, and the Medical Officer of Health of Alberta recently very courageously revealed that there is what he calls a cancer epidemic at Fort Chipewyan, which is about 50 kilometers by air from the center of the work activity of the tar sands. And he says there is a direct link between this cancer epidemic and the emissions into the air and the water of the chemicals used in refining the crude, the bitumen into synthetic crude.
Is there any organized opposition to further development in Fort McMurray or other places in the region?
There are some people who are very concerned about the industrialization of farmland around Edmonton, because the terrain is so difficult around Fort McMurray. The idea now is to get the oil out of the Athabasca tar sands and down to Edmonton, where it can be refined more quickly. But it's industrializing the whole agricultural region, and there are a number of farm organizations that are fighting that. There are environmental organizations that are appalled by the fact that we will emit more greenhouse gases from the tar sands into the air than all the rest of the emissions that Canada already exceeds under the Kyoto Agreement. There are people fighting for labor is fighting for better treatment of its workers, and there are small groups of coalitions of environmentalists and nationalists and so on who are opposed to that. But against them are $100 billion worth of investments in the tar sands in the next 10 years, which have already been granted by the Alberta government. The oil and gas industry are the closest thing to being a church or to being sacred as you can find in Alberta. To be against oil is almost to be against God in the minds of the government and the majority of people. Alberta has this huge surplus that doesn't seem to know what to do with. And in the meantime, this energy, this pool of energy that is in the north of the province is causing huge problems for many people. I think the main opposition to the tar sands lies in our report, actually, where we call for a 5-year moratorium on any new construction or development of the tar sands or the Mackenzie Valley natural gas pipeline until such time as there can be a national debate, a national discussion involving all sectors of society in all parts of Canada on developing a national energy strategy so that we look at our energy resources, we look at our energy needs, we look at the environment, we look at the infrastructure, we look at the social services, and then we develop a strategy for that would say something like Canada has these huge reserves of oil. We should first of all look after our own needs. We should first of all look after the needs of the environment and of the people that live in these regions. And then if there's oil left over, we can export it, and we can phase it in and out in a way that is controlled by Canada rather than by the United States.
Well, thank
you.
It's
interesting to me that the United States, the first act of the George W. Bush administration, in even before 9/11, was to cut Dick Cheney loose and develop what Canada has rejected, a national energy policy. And that energy policy states that oil is the single largest and single most important national security issue in the United States, access to this 25 million barrels a day plus that Americans use, largely for its war machine, which many of us think also makes Canada complicit in the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, and other military adventures that the United States is always undertaking.
Well, thank you for speaking with me today, Hugh.
Nice to talk to you.
I've been speaking with Hugh McCollum, author of the report Fueling Fortress America. You can find links to the report on our website, coopradio.org/redeye.